Welcome to the seventh episode of Spotlight Asia, live from Myanmar. I am Inga Michalek and part of Polis 180, a grassroots think tank on European and foreign affairs. We founded Connecting Asia to encourage a young discourse on political, economic, and cultural themes in the Asia-Pacific region, a region that often does not get enough attention in the Western media. In this podcast, Spotlight Asia, we talk to the people who shape our perception of the region most. On-the-ground journalists working in both print and online media. Our topic today is the military coup in Myanmar. Though previous podcasts have been recorded in German, this one is in English due to the different origins of our guests and to reach a broader audience. On February 1st, 2021, the military in Myanmar staged a coup, effectively taking control of the country. With claims of a fraudulent election, a year-long state of emergency was declared, with Army General Min Aung Hlaing assuming all state power for the duration of this period in his capacity as Commander-in-Chief. Since then, over 700 peaceful protesters have been killed and over 3,000 detained. Among those, elected leaders Daw Aung San Suu Kyi, President U Win Min and other members of the elected National League for Democracy, NLD. In the past 3 months, Myanmar has seen its largest protests in more than a decade. Since the 888 uprising against military totalitarianism in 1988. Masses have taken to the streets demanding the return to democracy, especially in the most populated cities of Yangon and Mandalay. Protesters launched a renewed civil disobedience movement, CDM, to encourage the public to stop going to work, boycott businesses owned by the military, and join anti-coup protests. Consequently, military backlash has been substantial, with tear gas, rubber bullets, psychological terror, active fire, and physical torture employed regularly against civilians. In this episode, it is our pleasure to have Christian Jaberdi as our moderator, who is a PhD candidate in South and Southeast Asian Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. He studies the history of Burmese art, literature, and music, and the creation of a national culture for Burma at the end of the 19th century. Before his doctoral studies, Christian worked as a freelance journalist in Myanmar, and most recently has been writing a blog on Myanmar history and culture, which you can find in the description below. In this podcast, we hope to paint a clear picture of the situation in Myanmar, the figures involved, the role of ASEAN and EU, as well as historical parallels to the Rohingya crisis in 2017. We hope you find this podcast to be informative and learn how you can become active supporter for the people and protesters in Myanmar.
Today we will be discussing the current political situation in Myanmar with Thin Le Win, a Burmese journalist and specialist correspondent, and the founder and former chief, of course, of Myanmar Now News Agency. Hello, Thin.
Hello.
Talking to Thin will be Tyke Tyke, a PhD researcher in law at the Queen Mary University of London, a human rights advocate, and a member of Myanmar's Rohingya minority ethnic group. Hello, Tyke.
Hello, everyone.
Tyke and Thin will be talking to Min Tempo, a Burmese independent consultant, focused on democracy, elections, and human rights.
Hello.
All right, welcome, everybody. My first question for you guys, and one that maybe you'd like to discuss for our listeners, is the situation is changing so rapidly right now on the ground in Myanmar. What is it like on the ground as we speak?
I guess I'll just go ahead first. I just wanted to say that there's been a lot of, people comparing images and videos coming out of Myanmar these days to a war zone. And I just want to quote a human rights activist who said that this is not a war zone. This is actually slaughter. That's what we're seeing right now in Myanmar. This is essentially security forces, police, and the military turning their guns on innocent protesters who are protesting peacefully and without arms. It is extremely grim. It is horrifying and heartbreaking. And I guess that's the three words that I will use just to sum up the situation. Grim, because the prospects that the military is going to back down or cease sense anytime soon is getting dimmer and dimmer. We heard what they supposedly told the UN special envoy, that they are willing to suffer through isolation and sanctions to just get their own ends. Horrifying because, you know, so many of my loved ones, friends and extended family members are still back home in Myanmar. This whole sense of unprovoked and senseless assault on unarmed protesters, like I said earlier, and it's heartbreaking because, you know, there's a real possibility that Myanmar is going to again shut down and people are going to live in fear and isolation for who knows how long. As someone, and I think it's similar to Min and Tai, right, who grew up in the 80s and the 90s during the last dictatorship era, I remember how isolating and terrifying it was to always constantly be worried about what you are saying and what you are doing and what you are allowed and not allowed to do. And I really fear that is going to be the future for a new generation of young Burmese.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. Especially the whole situation we've seen lately since, the Myanmar bloodiest day on 28th of February. It's now more and more like killing and shooting of innocent protesters. And then I've seen I didn't remember exactly. It was one of the news agency yesterday still reporting like battlegrounds. And then CNA reported 2 days ago using rubber bullets, you know. And I was like, no, it's not. I mean, like a mix of both rubber bullets and actual live rounds. And also it's not a battle zone, a battlefield. It's slaughter. It's a massacre.
I would like to add that, you know, and we heard that the military is coming with the truck, you know, in the city like Yangon and Mandalay in February. And it's reminding me of a situation in Rakhine State where 2012, 2016 and 2017, the Rohingya crisis has brutally cracked down by this same military. And we also see the picture of Battalion 77, you know, 33 has the same crackdown, you know, in the protester in Mandalay and also Yangon. I feel like the situation is, I have a sense in the picture through the phone call. I'm again in the same situation with their friend in Burma, talking to them, and then they are worried. And the police brutality is continuing.
Okay, so for those of our listeners who maybe need a little bit more background, who are the players involved in the current political situation in Myanmar?
Yeah, so the crackdown, the military has taken over in the coup, throwing the civilian government in the 1st of February. So since then, the youth group has taken the stage, you know, to be in the front line of this protest. So there are a few groups. We have come up with a different idea. You can see the protests, big protests ongoing, but however, there's quite a divided, you know, like some people think restoring 2020 election and bringing back NLD in power is the demand. Is the step forward, but however, there are also other group who think the situation will not be anything different if restoring 2020 election and bringing back the NLD in power, because since they have a failure to negotiate or to bring a move forward the political situation in Burma. That's why we are here today again under the military. There are also ethnic groups who are demanding we need a federal democracy and we need to have a federal institution from this political movement. Basically, when you see like all those youth on the street, they are more the activist group or labor union or teacher group and the worker So it's a different forces coming together. It's not like a one political party leading this revolution. It's all coming together, especially the public.
Yeah, I think I'd just like to echo, you know, what Tait says there. So, you know, for a very long time, I don't know if Gomin and Tait will also agree with me, you know, for a very long time, I think if you look at Myanmar political landscape, it would be the military and Aung San Suu Kyi, right? And perhaps some of the ethnic armed groups on the sideline. In a horrible way, but perhaps, hopefully, for the better of the country, the field is now much wider. You know, it used to be just that. As tragic as it is, it suddenly seems that there are just a lot more sort of, you know, players on the scene than there had been before, right? Because Aung San Suu Kyi, we haven't heard from her, since she was detained on the 1st of February. Now there is the committee representing Pidu Lutso, which is the, you know, representing the elected leaders, which is at the moment very strictly NLD, and that is a problem. But there's also, you know, like what Tai was saying, there's the, you know, the general strike, I think, movement or the CDM, and also the ethnic parties that are, activists, labor activists, ethnic rights activists, environmental activists, you know, a lot, and just young artists and journalists that are all sort of coming together and getting involved in the protests and the civil disobedience movement. And in a way, the military has created a completely new group of very, very determined opponents that goes beyond the NLD and DOSU.
Yes, true. And also it's always been in Myanmar since, colonial time. I'm just referencing my research on majoritarian nationalism, Buddhist nationalism in Myanmar. So military has been playing, and also other Burmese politicians have been playing this majoritarian politics, over decades. And it's always been like Martin and Tait mentioned before, you know, it's a NLD, the opposition and the military. But right now, all these youth groups and all the activists are, especially the young generation, they are now really united and connected together. So they all see right now it's a common threat for the country. It's the military and the Bomba nationalists, military, of course. And then so I think that is a positive way forward to be, because I have never seen anything like this before, especially the young generation I've seen. And also, but older generation, I will say, I've seen a lot still pro this NLD, and then only asking about releasing of Aung San Suu Kyi, Uy Myint, and restoring 2020 election results, and then forming the government. You know, but apart from that, all the other activists are asking for, you know, more unite federal union and everything. So I think that's one good thing coming out of it. It just unintentionally the military kind of united to unite all these, you know, like different forces joined together.
My question is, are there particular people in the way that under the NLD you have Aung San Suu Kyi or Komin Nine, or, you know, these people who are rising up in the CDM movement? Are there particular leaders who are being who we might focus on?
I mean, regarding the CDM, I'm like Gominko Nine, he's been vocal about it, and then, you know, like encouraging people, sharing messages and things. But no, I wouldn't say call him as a leader though. I mean, because it's the whole thing started, especially the youth group and the student group. So it's there like human rights defenders, activists in Myanmar, in just to like a few people, and then everyone is joining up. So I wouldn't call it there's a certain leader, but people are moving forward the same goal on a different level. Yeah.
And, you know, and I think in a way it's great, because it is almost organic. Obviously, there are people who, you know, organize the protests and then, you know, share the times for the protests and, you know, sort of rally people around to either join the CDM or, you know, bang the pots and pans. But I think it is really great that there isn't, you know, like in the 1988, right? There isn't a single actor like Dosu or Gomen Gonai that has come up. Because to be perfectly honest with you, I think Myanmar, the whole country, just really needs to get away from hero worship. You know, what we need is a critical mass of people who believe in, you know, the fundamental human rights and democratic values, not a single or a couple, even a group of superhumans. Because we've, for so long, have been focused on a single person, and we need to move away from that.
Okay, so what role then do other countries in the region have in this crisis? I mean, the ASEAN nations, Association of Southeast Asian Nations, what role can they play in the crisis as it unfolds? What should they be doing?
ASEAN in general, they have this non-intervention policy, and they don't really do much apart from, releasing a few statements, and then just talking with the junta in general. So to be honest, from my side, I don't really expect or hope that the role that they can play, because I remember during 2007, Seven Revolution, there have been rights group and activists call Singapore especially to not sanction, but just more like restrict the generals at the time, the business interests, and also like providing medical treatments during that time, especially to the military generals. And then the Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong said in an interview that they can't do that as a neighbor of Myanmar and ASEAN. You know, they understand the situation, but they will cooperate, you know, or yeah, some sort of things. So what they can do, they can pressure the military and the junta for stop, you know, brutally cracking down on innocent civilians, and also just more about engaging in the political talk. So far, I haven't seen much of them. I mean, they did tell it was Bernard Mongrin the other day in a live interview. I was in their Zoom conference, saying, you know, like regarding immediate release of the detainees and, you know, things. But I don't see much from the ASEAN on what they can do.
No, I think like when we say ASEAN, there it may be two part. One is the people, right? One is the governments. As Min has mentioned, the ASEAN government has a quite a non-interfering policy, but the people support is already there. I mean, I can tell about from Thailand. Myaw line is quite close to Thailand, Prayuth and their. The governments, we know that there is a quite kind of a coordination. However, you can see the people quite support the protests, and they were even trying to restore, you know, trying to the same demonstration and protest in Thailand. And there was a kind of solidarity. I think I can't remember which day it was last week. One solidarity protest in Thailand. And I know that one also in Malaysia. And so far, I think this has been quite supportive from ASEAN community, people community, but not the government community as we know it. And one particular thing happened in Malaysia, Myanmar government tried to bring back, I don't know, like it was 2000 or 1400, detainee back, and then there was a court process saying, the court order saying that it's not they cannot. But however, the Myanmar government has brought back without listening to the court order. So those kind of thing is a kind of environment has a kind of changes, not to rush to support to their military government in a way. At least the Thailand say, okay, this is their, we can't say anything because the Thai is a Myanmar issue, but it didn't say like a Thai government completely. This is like, oh, we have to support as a military in kind of open way. However, I think there's very clear of the government position and people position in when it's come to ASEAN.
Yeah, and you know, I guess I wasn't expecting a lot from ASEAN, but it is still disappointing. Because like Min said, you know, they have this whole, you know, non-interference policy. But also, you know, there seemed to be a massive disconnect between what a lot of the people in Myanmar think the international community can do versus what the international community can really do, right? You will see in a lot of the protests, in, you know, all the posters and in interviews and on tweets and Facebook, they will say, you know, how many, you know, bodies would it take for the UN to intervene? They will call for R2P responsibility to protect, to be invoked. You know, they in fact ask, you know, like the militaries from other countries to essentially, you know, invade Myanmar. And a lot of it is really unrealistic, unfortunately. And it is not going to happen. And that's, you know, it's really sad. However, having said that, I think ASEAN in some ways can do a bit more than the UN or even the US if they wanted to. You know, I remember during Cyclone Nargis, it was ASEAN, you know, the UN and the junta, then the tripartite working group that sort of managed to bring in much needed aid to the country after the cyclone devastated, you know, the Irrawaddy Delta. And, you know, for example, like Tait says, you know, Thailand, you know, very, very close militarily. Singapore is where a lot of the business interests are. There's a lot of bank accounts from, you know, military associated companies. There's a lot of investment in Myanmar, you know, happens both ways. And there are things that they could do to sort of at least bring the military to, you know, in line with at least something. And yet they are refusing to do it. Like, you know, Tait said, you know, Prime Minister of Singapore, Lee Hsien Loong, talked about, oh, yes, you know, this is really bad. They shouldn't do this. And yet they are not willing to actually do any, you know, any penalties, impose any penalties for Myanmar to the junta for, you know, all these human rights abuses. And that is really disappointing because I do think they can do something. And I don't know what it will take for them to change because, you know, people much more tune in than me, you know, with the political and diplomatic circles and all that stuff have said this could become a regional insecurity issue if we're going to have, you know, ethnic armed groups starting to fight even more with the military and then suddenly people started fleeing the borders. What's going to happen? I really hope it won't take, you know, that kind of tragic circumstances for ASEAN to act, but I'm just not seeing them do anything that could actually, you know, make the junta listen.
Yes, I agree.
I have a question that I think might be relevant to our listeners. Maybe one for Min. What role has the EU played in Myanmar in recent years leading up to this crisis? And then what role might it play in the coming months?
For EU, I mean, EU has been very, very, I would say, friendly, you know, dealing with the military junta since, I think since 2012, 2011, especially with this MIPOL police training program, even though EU... I mean, they denied it. They denied it the fact that they didn't provide it the brutal what's it called, the brutal tactics, the chapter in the training process that was Myanmar police added themselves after. But there has been ongoing a lot of ongoing EU like support and the close ties with the military junta in general. One of my friends, a journalist, was saying yesterday with me, we were talking. It was mentioning that, for example, he met then EU ambassador at the time in 2011 or 2012. So just asking, just talking in general about what to do with the military government, with the military and the junta and the police. So he advised, you know, like just not to have a close tie with them, keeping caution and then just be careful, especially with the training. But I quote, he said, the ambassador said, actually, we are doing the opposite. We are going to be have friendly terms with them. So as you can see, the violent crackdown on Lebanon protests in 2015 March, it's from the police training received I mean, the from the MIPO program, and you see and still like this cracking down on innocent protesters. And regarding the EU, today as well, I saw it. My friends and activists sharing about Emmanuel Macron, you know, statement on Myanmar. To me, yeah, it is just a pure statement. But because at the back behind, like France has been involved with, you know, total FINALF in Myanmar, especially this border pipeline project in 2006 and 2007, all these like human rights abuses, anything. So it just at the same time you can release a statement from one of the EU or European EU governments, at the same time, you know, just keep supporting total FINALF and also what is the American one? Chevron, you know, all these like oil and gas companies. So I would say EU should be more aware in the future of dealing with the junta, the military in general, rather than they should really start thinking about considering their own policy and approach when approaching to do anything with Myanmar generals.
Did you want to say something?
Yes. I think what was the justification from EU side was, almost all project in Myanmar was the civilian government invitations. So they always tell you, oh, your civilian government has invited us to do this and that. So we were there. But again, as Main has highlighted in his last talk, that it has to be by principle, and then it's not like it's a government has invited. If you see like there is a kind of offer, not real democratic society or democratic government. I mean, my question is also like, what will be now? Okay, there's no civilian government for now. So what can be their policy to continue from these circumstances?
Min, you mentioned a number of companies that are either doing business, international companies doing business with the Myanmar military, or doing business with companies owned or collaborating with the Myanmar military. Maybe we can talk a bit about that.
I mean, I didn't have the actual list. I mean, I saw the list from Justice for Myanmar, but so I can tell regarding digital companies, but just out of my knowledge, because at the time, especially with Total and all the human rights abuses, and then it's a French-owned company, and then it was just like, I mean, it was still under the military regime, under the military junta at the time, 2006, 2004, and all these like problems along Thai-Myanmar border and everything. And then I didn't hear or see at the time, I mean, any like announcement regarding that issue from French government, from the EU, and it keeps on going. Total is still there in Myanmar. So that's, and then of course, I mean, Chevron, it's already been there. So I don't know whether they're actually dealing with the military companies all this oil and gas company, it's also play a huge role in Myanmar.
Maybe we can take it in Tyke's direction. Obviously for our listeners, the coup comes on the tails of the Rohingya genocide in 2017. And many, many, many Rohingya people are still living in squalid camps along the Myanmar-Bangladesh border. And recently, India's Coast Guard picked up a boat with over 90 people in it that had been adrift in the Bay of Bengal without food or water for several days. And 8 people were found dead on board. These were Rohingya trying to get away from Bangladesh. So I'm just interested to ask, what will be the effect of this coup on the peace process for Rohingya people?
First of all, you know, the situation for Rohingya is always connected to the political situation in Myanmar, Burma, because since it's not out of the situation, because whatever happening in the whole country is also part of the Rohingya problem. Although you would say, okay, the situation in Rohingya has no change because they has been always under this military crackdown, you know, it's the situation the same. However, in kind of peace process or any kind of situation to improve, there is no way to go ahead with this military governments, because although all the attention is in the central Burma or in other part of Burma, we don't know how the military will be treating the Rohingya in coming day and months. There's no guarantee of safety, and the Rohingya are very vulnerable. So that's very worrying. I know that there is a kind of a Myanmar has mentioned in their speech, I think it was the first day when he appeared in the TV, is talking about repatriations, but it was a kind of a quite a general message, and he didn't even say the word Rohingya. He said, oh, we will have to continue bringing the people and the refugees from other countries. So which he mean, including those he was planning to bring the detainee in the Malaysia, and then also the bringing back from Rohingya from Bangladesh camp. However, he didn't say the word Rohingya. Yes, so that was a kind of approach from military in the camps area in Sitwe, and saying that all the things happened was the fall of NLD. Was they try to be, you know, now coordinate with them. I mean, obviously, this is a kind of trying to persuade them, you know, in somehow to be quiet or in this kind of movement. I know that there is a very difficult situation to say that repression can happen, because there's no safe for everyone in the country, and then there's no way the Rohingya will be safe again in these situations. So I don't think that any repatriation is a good timing. And however, in the peace process, when I see the peace process, I mean, there are different layers, right? There can be peace process, you know, in with the government, you know, like with the Rohingya or with the other ethnic group in Burma, you know, the Rohingya. And somehow there is a kind of political space, as Martin has also mentioned, to open up what was like a Rohingya crisis to discussions with among Burma majority. Some people are like posting Facebook saying that, oh, we're sorry for this, what happened, because we didn't speak up for them and we didn't stand up for them, and we apologize for these things. And so there was a kind of environment, like a kind of discussion about the Rohingya issue, because they are now in the same situations. So it opened up a kind of space to acknowledge what happened to the Rohingya, which was completely denial for a year. And then even people stand up with the Aung San Suu Kyi and the government to support the military clearance operation in Rakhine State. So in one point, there is a kind of a light within all this horrible thing happening, because some people voluntarily, well, I mean, say a few people, actually, it's not quite a majority. It's also come from the community and activists or celebrity or, I don't know, influencer level. It's not like a politicians. It's not, no politicians say that. An environment of acknowledging what happened to Rohingya, although there is no political changes yet. But in another point, I don't think any repatriations or any kind of peace process with their, you know, solving the restoring the 1982 citizenship is still on the way.
That's the 1982 citizenship law?
Exactly, yes.
And can you maybe for our listeners give us a bit of background on that?
Yeah, so according to 1982 citizenship law, the Rohingya are not recognized as a citizen of Burma anymore. Before that, Rohingya were a citizen of Burma. So the 1982 citizenship law is like was drafted by New Win governments. Obviously, there are so many problems because there are three different class of citizenship, where you have to get a requirement of your and center, you know, being in providing a document. However, this is the kind of law. There is also so many layer of discrimination against Rohingya. Even though some Rohingya can prove you have identity card from the previous law, citizenship law, they are still denied. So the layer from the law and from the implementation. So they're not included. Although you say, oh, I have the ID card, but they are still asked you to provide your N-Center document, which is not possible for many people. Which is double standard in other part of the country. They will not ask you those kind of questions. If you say, I have my parent has ID card, they will simply get probably one. But where it's not the same for the Rohingya. So since 1982, then slowly, gradually, the civil right has been taken away, like no movement restriction, you know, limited to their education access. I mean, since 2012 and 2016-17, it was impossible for Rohingya to be in the university anymore. Before that, it was limited, but since this crisis, and there's not possible anymore. And even for the healthcare, In, for example, in Mount or Butidang, you know, in those township are very, like it's in by car, like it's just 40 minutes by car. Even to go to, from one township, people have to get travel authorization for the immigration, where which they have to pay money and allow the journey from one place to, like from Butidang to Mount or Mount to Butidang, which is just 45 minute journey. They have to show this travel document in every checkpoint present, and they will ask you maybe money and then give money extortion. So this thing have been happening like 40 years.
But I think also, right, there is this whole, I think there is a massive generation gap, really, that is becoming much clearer and clearer in these protests. And a lot of the people who are apologizing and rethinking are younger people, and who perhaps have not had those decades of propaganda, right, drummed into them about how, oh, these are Rohingyas are not, you know, they're Bengalis from across the border, they're illegal immigrants, you know, and it is probably just, yeah, and you know, I think a lot of the younger people also have a much wider group of friends, you know, from different religions and races, whereas it used to be very much along ethnicity and religious lines. You know, just going back to whether the, you know, what's going to happen to the Rohingya, I mean, you know, I guess the short answer is nothing good, right? Because the same people that have drove them from their home in such a horrible way and inflicted this unimaginable horror are now in power, right? Not just in terms of nationally, which is the same military, you know, and the light infantry division that, as far as I understand, the light infantry division that was involved in those so-called clearance operations are now in Yangon and Mandalay and shooting protesters. So that's, you know, pretty brutal. That's the same guys that are now in power. That's at the national level. And then in the Rakhine state level, they've also, you know, released from prison. I mean, we can argue whether or not this particular politician should have been in prison in the first place. That's another issue. But this, you know, there is a particular politician called Uwe Mao, right? That's his name, if I got it right, who is virulently anti-Rohingya. Horrible. He's been released, you know, and they've now started organizing again. And I suspect there will be some agitation that might happen, you know, within the Rakhine state as well, if something happens, as any resettlement happens. So, you know, it's just horrible in so many ways. Oh, and one, you know, three strikes, right? The first strike is that the military is now in power. Two is the second one, you know, an extremely anti-Rohingya politician is back probably in power. Number three, you know, at the national level, the Ministry of Relief and Resettlement, the social welfare, relief, and resettlement is now being overseen by a woman who, again, is virulently anti-Rohingya.
I think also it's also now the younger generation are more open, and also technology has a kind of bring back together. You know, like it's quite. I know it's a kind of either it's a bad or good message. It's kind of quite viral. You know, it's to spread. It's very easily. As I said previously, like kind of divided, and as also Martin highlighted, the older generation are more like a they're kind of holding more like a political agenda, where the younger generation, you know, they are more open in kind of social level discussions. You know. Although I might be also the same regret for the older generation, but they were probably not ready to open up and say this thing to in the publicly because they have their own political agenda. So that is also one problem. Yeah.
In your opinion, what is the path forward for democracy in Myanmar at the moment? If you can make a prediction, if you were to make a prediction, what prediction would you make and why?
Oh gosh, that is an extremely difficult question. I wish I know, because then I'd then I would know how to help the country. Do you know? I think it is. Look, to be perfectly honest with you, it hurts me to say this, but I am not seeing a way out that doesn't involve a lot of bloodshed, because the military is absolutely brutal and ruthless. And they will keep shooting and killing people. The question is, how much would that take for neighboring countries to start actually doing something, or even people within the country, you know, some soldiers or police or whatever, to start thinking this is not something I want to take part in. And that's going to take time. Having said that, I do think that, you know, the civil disobedience movement is still pretty crucial, because in the eyes of, you know, international acceptance, you know, as a sovereign nation, to show that there is, you know, that to show that the country, the citizenship, utterly rejects the military, because that would then put pressure on places like the UN and other organizations not to recognize the junta, and even perhaps, you know, pressure some of the ASEAN countries and others not to openly recognize the junta. That means, you know, businesses that wants to do deals with the junta cannot do it officially, cannot get loans from the US or the EU or, you know, central banks. And I know it sounds less exciting in a way and legalese, but I do think it is going to be crucial going forward to try and somehow keep that going, to show the rest of the world that these are not legitimate rulers. And, you know, there are a lot of issues with the 2008 constitution. I'm not a fan of it. And I completely agree that, you know, that needs to be scrapped and redone. Having said that, you know, I will continue to use it to point out that what the junta did with the coup is absolutely illegitimate. It does not even follow their own constitution. It is illegal. And in a way, that is to essentially shame the kind of countries that like to support the junta into, you know, either not support them publicly or at least admit, yes, we know that they broke the law and we know it was unconstitutional, but we don't care. But at least come out and say it, that you do not care about anything, and that will be on your blacklist. I mean, that's my own personal, you know, thing that I want to do. I know it doesn't really answer your question, but that's the best I can do.
Yeah, I think, like, as Martin has pretty much covered what the situation currently, but what I want to add is that this is something we need to do quickly, you know, reforming a government structure, including with the ethnic solidarity, and also trying to get a kind of reform or a new armed forces for protecting the people. That just did not happen very quickly, and it's very slow. And currently, there is a bit quite complex situation going. Although CRPH is a kind of a leading body for international community, not everyone in the country has agreed on what they are doing. Yeah, so this the body, the legitimate body, the international community is recognized as a representative. However, the work they are doing is quite slow, and they're not really outreaching other forces to cooperate with them or to reform the government. I know there is a kind of a structure they has released, I think it was yesterday or the other day. But however, they're still very not clear, you know. There's no constitution, as we know that what going to be the new constitution. Is going to be a new one, or is it which constitution are we really taking for the next step? That is a bit unknown in this day, and I'm worried. I mean, I'm afraid that this military is escalating every day, you know, and it will be continuing and day by day. And then we need like a quick action, and then will be maybe a channel to ask the help from international community if there is a body or kind of a proper government structure in the country and with a constitution, at least even a kind of a draft or, you know, like an idea of the constitutions, and reforming with other, inviting other task forces and ethnic group and to participate in this reforming new governments. I don't know how much is parallel structure will be continued, because of course the army has their own plan. You know, here are the civilian reforming a parallel government or alternative, you know, whatever the term, is kind of slow. And although, because the army is quite small, they have all the plan, you know, one by one. So I'm afraid that we need to be really smart and very quickly moving forward on this process, but it's not happening. Yeah.
If someone who is listening now wants to support the pro-democracy movement and human rights in Myanmar, what can they do? What can they do right now?
I have 2 points. One is you can support the people who are taking part in the civil disobedience movement. There are quite a few different, you know, and legitimate organizations and groups that are supporting people on the ground through the Hundi network and all that sort of stuff to try and make sure that there's, you know, money for people in the civil service or in the private sector who decided to not go to work and take part in civil disobedience movement. 2 that I know and I totally trust, if people are interested, there is a group on chuft.org called Support the Myanmar People in Their Fight for Freedom that's raising funds. And, you know, I know the people behind them. They call themselves Friends of Myanmar, but I personally know them. And they have transferred at least, I think, $15,000 to people on the ground. There's another group that's being set up called Mutual Aid Myanmar by 3 academics, one of whom is Burmese. And they're going to be a 501c organization in the US, which means if institutional groups want to support them, that is a good way to send funds through. The second point is please support independent media, particularly in ethnic areas. This is one of the few ways people outside like us are finding out what's happening over there. And they, you know, independent journalists and media are getting hammered terribly. They need all the support they can get.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thanks so much for talking to us today, guys. If you, our listeners, would like to learn more about Polis 180 or any of the speakers you've heard here today, we've included links in the description for you. We hope that you will come and listen with us again on the next episode of our podcast series, Spotlight Asia. Thanks for being here, guys.
This Polis 180 podcast solely represents the author's opinion, does not speak for Polis 180 as an organization. Polis 180 is a grassroots think tank that translates scientific insight for political decision makers. We introduce our generation's ideas, analyses, and solutions into the political discourse through innovative and inclusive approaches and develop real alternatives for constructive foreign and European policy.